Welcome, everyone, to episode 164 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we are joined by a very special guest, former Charlotte Hornets general manager Rich Cho. He's going to walk us through how NBA teams prepare for the offseason, including the draft, free agency, basically give us a behind-the-scenes look at how that all goes down. Before we get underway, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're now being hosted on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so check them out on Twitter, at Almighty Casts. One more disclaimer before we get underway. We recorded this in June, so if any references are out of date, that's why. With all that said, joining me today, as always, is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
Brian, it's going so well. I just had Indian for dinner, and that means I'm in a great mood.
I did that Saturday as well, so that's, yeah, great minds, I guess. And speaking of food and, frankly, the offseason, as mentioned, we have a very special guest on today. Rich Cho, the former general manager of the Charlotte Hornets, is joining us to give us that behind-the-scenes look at the offseason. So, Rich, how's it going? Thanks for joining us.
Doing well. Thanks for having me. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Before we get underway, Rich, I want to give you a chance to plug anything you want, Twitter, Instagram. Be our guest.
Okay. Well, my Instagram and Twitter are at Big Time Bites. And my website, my food blog, is BigTimeBites.com. So check it out.
Very good. Yeah. And for the foodies out there, we're going to walk through some NBA stuff first, but at the end of the episode, we'll go back and talk about Big Time Bites as well. So check it out in the meantime while you're listening to the rest of the episode. So Rich, the first question we have for you, I mean, this is really just the overall general question, because we obviously, you know, do not work for an NBA team. We do not have a behind the scenes look of how these things go. So the draft is in a week, basically. Free agency starts, I think, within 2 or 3 weeks. I'm guessing the offseason prep has started by now for most teams. But when do you really start to, like, buckle down and prepare for this upcoming offseason as a general manager? Is it after the trade deadline, or are you looking like, you know, have you been preparing for the 2018 offseason since 2015, 2016?
Yeah, well, preparation for the offseason is really year-round. And the biggest part of the offseason is obviously the draft and free agency. So it's something that you're constantly preparing for from the standpoint of scouting players and gathering intel on players. And, you know, as an NBA team, you have to prepare short-term and long-term. So the prep is really year-round. It's kind of nonstop. Really, the only downtime in the NBA cycle is probably the end of August, and that's when most of the guys around the front office take their vacations. But as far as prep, it's really year round.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, Brian and I, several times regarding, like, how to prepare in the summer. And we always figure, like, you have to look at it from, like, a more wholesome perspective, because you can't just, like, a couple weeks before the summer go, oh, now we get into, like, this mode of how do we construct our roster for the next couple of years. Like, you have to be on point for basically the whole season and beforehand. So I want to ask you about the draft, like, in specifically regarding the draft. Like, when does, like, scouting of particular prospects, like, ramp up? I mean, you obviously cast a wide net over a lot of these prospects, but when do you really, like, hone in on someone? And even before that, like, do you have meetings prior to the season to really look at, okay, these are the guys we're going to consider at draft time? What is that whole process? Like, how does that come about?
So, you know, every team's got their own philosophy and infrastructure, but teams typically have 4 or 5 full-time college scouts, a pro scout, and an international scout. So some teams have more than that. Some teams have less than that. But that's probably typical. Other teams utilize regional scouts that are based in cities around the country who just scout games in that particular region. I'm not a fan of that philosophy because I think it's important to ask a scout, for example, to break down the difference between, say, Colin Sexton and Trae Young, and for accountability purposes, I want to put them on the on notice and ask them who they would prefer. So, you know, as far that's kind of a little bit on how a team's structured scouting wise. You also have your assistant GM and your GM and your director of player personnel. They'll do a lot of scouting as well during the season. But the scouting process for the draft starts in July. So you've got different camps put on by the shoe companies, the Adidas camp, the Nike camp, Under Armour camp. And in those camps, you get an up-close look at different prospects for the upcoming year, as well as young guys who might be a year away from college. And then on the international side, you've got different tournaments in Europe by age group. You've got Basketball Without Borders and various other events. So, you know, as far as the different meetings and things like that, what I've done in the past is have a scouting and front office retreat right before training camp. And the purpose of that meeting is to set the table for the upcoming season. And typically what you're going to talk about, or what I've talked about in the past, is, you know, the state of the team, players on your own team, players who are on your team that are going to be free agents at the end of the year. I think it's important to get to, because your scouts typically are not located in the city that the team is located, just for financial purposes. The scouts might not see your team on an everyday basis. So you want to make sure that the scouts have a good feel and pulse of the team and the landscape of how the team's constructed, who's going to be a free agent, who's not going to be a free agent, and maybe what you're looking for from a scouting standpoint. So other things that you're going to talk about in this, you know, in your retreat or draft meetings at the start of the season, you know, what are we looking for from a scouting standpoint? You want to make sure that everyone's on the same page. So you can't just send out scouts and around the country and go to different games and not be on the same page. So what are, you know, different important characteristics in players that each scout should be looking for when you're out there scouting? So, for example, is it skill level, athleticism, basketball IQ, toughness? What are the things that are important to you as a staff? So I think that's important to get everybody on the same page. And then the scouting report process. After you see a game, what's the process for getting the information back to the front office? And what format do we want that information in? And what content should it have in it? And then, you know, how long after game should that report be in? So, you know, those are all things that are kind of setting the table for the upcoming season. And, you know, as far as things that you know, you want in different reports, what I always emphasized to the scouts was, I never told the scouts what exactly to write and not to write, because I think it's important for scouts to have their own way of writing the scouting report. Every scout writes something a little different. You know, other teams use like a form and, you know, they're checking boxes or rating players or assigning a numeric value to different things. But what I always did was I'd have scouts write a scouting report. And like I said, I didn't tell them what to put in it or what not to put in it necessarily. But in general, what I'm looking for is, okay, what are the physical attributes of this player? What are the strengths of this player? Weaknesses, tendencies? What does he do offensively, defensively? How athletic is he? and what, you know, what makes this player an NBA player, and how good is he going to be when he reaches his prime?
It's interesting to hear you say. I mean, it makes total sense, but you know, the fact that the idea of this scouting retreat before the season and having them consider, you know, the construction of the roster, as you mentioned, and like which players are free agents, it makes me think, you know, I'm a Sixers guy. So, you know, from that perspective, like, I wonder if they say, okay, we just signed Joel Embiid to a 5-year deal. We don't need to necessarily scout, you know, centers as much as we do wings and ball handlers. It's interesting. But you mentioned as well, you know, you're asking scouts to dig into the physical attributes and athleticism and all that stuff. How about the off court, like character issues, you know, background information about, you know, we hear a lot about questions about motor in particular, especially with big men, it seems. How much do you dig into that stuff? How much do you weigh that compared to the physical attributes? And who do you talk to? Is it just like the college coach, their high school coaches, or are you also having, you know, we hear about the NFL, like they send like scouts out to bars to see if the top prospects are there. So how much does that stuff weigh in to the evaluation process?
Well, I think it's different for every team. Some teams are going to weigh it more than others, but with the teams that I've been on, we put a tremendous amount of weight in it. We spend a lot of time and effort gathering intel on players, and it'll be with their college coaches, assistant coaches, strength coaches, trainers, student managers, academic advisors, AAU people. You know, we want to know what their personality is like. What's their work ethic like? Does he come in for extra work outside of practice, or is he, you know, come into practice and then leave right after practice? Is he a leader or a follower? What's their family life like? How close are they to their family? What's his competitiveness like? Does he, you know, does he really hate to lose? And there's varying degrees of competitiveness. How much does he like basketball? Does he like the weight room? Does he smoke? Does he drink? Does he party? And what are some maybe off-court issues? If the player had an off-court issue, you know, you want to dig into that a little more too. And for different guys that we have a high focus group or focus on towards the end of the season, you know, we might do an FBI check on the player as well.
Wow, interesting.
So, I mean, that takes me back to the Pistons when they chose Andre Drummond, because they actually were looking at a way to kind of avoid picking another Darko. And I believe the Pistons brass at the time expressed that they have gone into like 10 times, 100 times the background check just to make sure that they did not end up with, well, I don't want to say with another bust, it just they had some complications with, for example, you know, Darko that they didn't anticipate. So I'm assuming just as the NBA has progressed as you know, the availability of information has you know, progressed, it's that much more essential to get, you know, proper intel on these guys. And in lieu of that, When you guys are doing a draft board, like at what point do you set that in stone with all this gathered information you just talked about? Like, does it remain fluid until you pick, or do you come into the draft with like a very set order and go, we know who we are going to pick here, here, and here if they're available, and here are our backup plans?
Well, I think if your process is done right, you're going to have your draft order set the night before the draft. What you don't want is to have chaos during the draft and be unprepared during the draft. So, you know, it's like the bar exam. If you're still studying the day of the bar, then you're not ready for it. So, you know, and I've taken and passed the bar exam, so I'm not just throwing that out. But you know, you're also – and you don't want a lot of chaos and disagreement when you're on the clock. But so typically as the draft unfolds, when it's your turn to pick, you're going to select the player on the top of your list that hasn't been drafted yet. Now, if you make a trade during the draft, that can change things and you'll have to, you know, pivot accordingly. But for the most part, you're going to have your draft board set in stone the night before the draft. And, you know, like I said, trades can change those things. And say if you make a trade during the draft, early in the draft, for, say, a backup point guard who you think, let's say a young backup point guard you think will be with your team for a long time, then maybe that changes your draft order a little bit. If you've got several players that are basically even in other regards, maybe you move that backup point guard back a little bit in your priority order.
Interesting. So whether you have your board set ideally before the draft, but even, you know, sometimes it might not happen until you're like the night of the draft or even until you're on the clock, how do you settle upon a consensus for, you know, if you have two prospects who you think are going to be available at your pick, or who, you know, if you're on the clock and you have two prospects who are available, they're closely ranked on your board, how do you settle a consensus between the scouts and other front office personnel at that point?
Well, I mean, that's a process of a lot of different meetings and with your scouts and your staff and combing through film and arguments and debates and disagreements. And, you know, you all want to be on the same page at the end of the day. And so you just have to work through it just like any other big decision. But it's something that's not easy because you've got, you know, a lot of debate among scouts and personnel, and which you should, you know, you should have a lot of healthy debate among your scouts in your front office, because you don't want everybody thinking the same way. But at the end of the day, you know, you have to come to some sort of consensus and have your draft order set, you know, the night before the draft.
And in terms of, you know, not just the draft order, but you mentioned trades, like you could make a trade on draft night. At what point do those conversations with other teams begin? I mean, we've read a couple articles from high-ranking media members who, like, go into the details of how a trade is made. And essentially, like, the vast majority of the points were made that a team doesn't just ring someone up and within 10 minutes they have a trade. It goes a long way back. It goes further back. And so we're curious to understand, like, when you do a draft day trade, like, how long has that conversation typically been ongoing? Like, and if you are willing to move a draft pick or a guy for a draft pick, like, how do you make that known?
Well, trades happen a lot of different ways. Sometimes they've developed over the course of a few weeks, over the course of a few months, and but sometimes they come up, you know, in an instant. So, you know, they might come up during the draft when you're on the clock, and it might be something that has never been brought up before by either you or another team. Maybe they made another trade, and it's something that just came up where now they're willing to trade this other player or their pick, and so they're bringing it to you for the first time during the draft when you know, as it leads up to your pick. So, but sometimes, a lot of times, these are conversations that have been had before in the weeks and months leading up to the draft. Maybe it's something earlier in the season that you have an interest in a certain player. They have an interest in one of your players, and nothing came to fruition as far as a trade. But you know, maybe they feel like, at the end of the year, as it leads up to the draft, hey, you know what? We're willing to part with this player now, whereas we weren't before. And so now you're going to drum up more conversations. And so it really happens a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's quick, sometimes it's slow. But for the draft, you always have to be prepared for a lot of different scenarios and be able to also make quick decisions.
So it can actually pop up fairly quickly, because that's been one of the things that, you know, NBA Twitter is very active about these things. And one of the main consensus out there is, oh, like, you can't complete a trade like within a couple hours, basically. But it seems to, if I'm understanding you accurately, like, that could actually pop up. Like, some deal could pop up on draft night that could be discussed. The details could be arranged and it could be executed on that very night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And as a front office, you have to be prepared, you know, with all your spreadsheets. You have to, you know every team's cap situation, every team's free agent situation, draft situation. So when a team calls or you're ready to call another team, that you're able to make split decisions, you know, if whether you're on the clock or leading up to when you're on the clock. So things do happen fast. I wouldn't say necessarily that's the norm, but it definitely does happen.
I think Mort is a recovering Bulls fan. I think he's still just scarred from the Jimmy Butler trade from last year. He's just making sure that Garpax did in fact shop Jimmy Butler to more than one team before the draft. That's my guess.
I think the bigger the deal, I think the less probability that it's going to happen in a split second if you haven't talked about it in the past.
Sure.
So, you know, there's that caveat too.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think about like the Kyrie Irving trade last summer too, and it seemingly, I mean, the trade request came out in July, but then it kind of went under wraps for a month. Like no one. In the public at least knew about it, and then all of a sudden, like, boom, he got traded to the Celtics. So before we go into the free agency side of things, I do have one more question. Just you mentioned kind of about trades, and I'm curious about like trade rumors, but you know, like Woj and Shams Charania of Yahoo, those guys are all on top of this stuff. Mark Stein of the New York Times as well. Who's feeding these guys? Is it mostly agents, or, you know, are GMs strategically leaking this kind of like, oh, you know, Kyrie Irving's available via trade, just putting it out there. And then are you like trying to feed interest and like drive up a bidding war through the media?
Well, I think it kind of depends. I think some front office guys feel the need to feed some of the media members so they won't write negative things about them or their teams. But other front office members, you know, really like to keep things close to the vest. I was more of a keep things close to the vest guy, kind of guy. And so, you know, some of the rumors out there, I know some of the rumors out there are false, because I'd see stuff about our team that I know darn well they're false. So you can't believe everything you see out there, but you're right. There is a lot of stuff out there that does wind up being true, and I'm not sure who's feeding some of those things out there, but you know, you just have to kind of take some of that with a grain of salt, and some of it's true, some of it's not.
Interesting. More any other questions about the draft, or should we go right into free agency?
I think we should go into free agency.
Cool. Okay. So then, you know, we'll put the draft aside. June 21st is over. We're now turning our attention to July 1st, the start of free agency. Rich, I guess the first question we have in that regard is, you know, when you're negotiating a contract with a potential free agent signee, obviously, the circumstances of your team will weigh a lot in terms of, you know, if you're a win now team, maybe you don't mind the ramifications 3 years down the road as much, or vice versa. But how do you weigh kind of, you know, the short and long term ramifications of any contract that you're willing to offer?
Well, I think when you're a team, you got to plan short and long term. So you're always going to plug numbers in and, you know, project short term and long term. Okay, if I give this player this deal at this amount of salary for X amount of years, this is what my salary book looks like. And, if, you know, if we do this, this, and this, this is what it looks like. So you're always looking at different salary models and how things can shape up from a flexibility standpoint and short and long-term ramifications. So it's a constant process because you always want to think short-term and long-term, and you never want to be in a situation where you know, you're not thinking of both those aspects.
So when you look at the potential, you know, signees out there, like how much information gathering do you guys do prior to like hitting the free agency market? Is it accurate to assume that the high profile free agents, they are so well known that you don't really have to do a whole bunch of background checks on them, and you don't really have to like do a whole bunch of research for them? But when it comes to like lesser known players, maybe young guys who are unrestricted, like then maybe you put more effort into to like looking at the player from a long-term perspective?
No, I don't think so, really. I think for the high-profile free agents, even though they're really well-known, so you're going to have to pay them a lot more, too. So I think it's really important to gather information on them throughout the year. And the pro scout I had in Charlotte did a great job for us, Todd Quinter, who has been in the league for 30 years. And he had so many contacts around the league. If I wanted information on a certain player, I could get it pretty easily. He could get it for me. Just with all his contacts, and he would gather information throughout the year, even if we didn't need it, you know, just from talking to guys around the league, but then we'd put it into our database, and we'd have that information in case a trade did come up. So you want to gather information on high-profile guys as well as guys that aren't necessarily high-profile, because you never know when you're going to need that information.
Now, you just brought up something interesting there, because I don't think a lot of people really talk about pro scouts. Like, mostly when we use the word scouts, we mostly use it in terms of draft-related stuff and content. So how much are pro scouts used in the NBA?
Well, when I got to Charlotte, 7 years ago, they didn't have a pro scout, fortunately, they allowed me to bring in a pro scout. And I think it's really important because, you know, you acquire players through the draft, free agency, and trades. And two-thirds of that consists of pro players, trades, and free agency. So it's really important to have a good pulse of what's going on in the NBA. And so that's pro scouting. So, you know, I had a Todd would go out to tons and tons of games each month, and he'd get a feel for all the guys in the NBA and send the information back to us. You know, when you're in the front office, whether it's being a GM or assistant GM, you know, you're traveling with the team part of the time. You're also out seeing some college games. And sometimes you don't have, you're not going to have time to see every single game of every team.
Right.
So you need a pro scout to not only see games in person, but see games on film. And then, report back to you, not just on the basketball aspect, but the background and intel aspect as well.
This is really interesting. I didn't, Mort, I'm right with you. I didn't really consider.
Yeah. I didn't know that either. That's very interesting. Like, that's a whole different component we actually haven't realized or discussed before. So that's very interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think pro scouting is really important. So, like, when you're a GM or let's say you guys, right? Yeah. You guys watch a lot of games on League Pass, and so when you're watching a game, a lot of times, you know, I do it myself. I'm not going to watch a game from start to finish necessarily if there's three other games on TV and those are close games that are ending. So I'm gonna turn the channel and watch the close games and then go back and forth. And so what a good pro scout will do is he'll see games in person. He'll see games on film. He'll break down guys for you on film and then send reports back to you accordingly. So he would have a great feel for the NBA, for each team, different players. And you know, I would meet with the pro scout before the season and kind of lay out, we'd lay out together, okay, what are we trying to accomplish here pro scouting wise for the year? These are the free agents that are going to be available at the end of the year. Let's focus on these guys. These are some potential trade targets that we like, and let's make sure we focus on these guys too. And so we'd have basically a plan put in place each month of the season. Okay, these are the guys that we want to see and focus on for the year. And then maybe your pro scout goes to see a team and somebody catches his eye and then he reports back to you and you talk about it. And I say, hey, why don't you go see that guy a few more times and gather some more information on him? Because he might be a guy we want to trade for, or maybe he's a guy we want to sign at the end of the year during free agency.
Mort, I think that means your dream of retaining David Nwaba for very cheap.
Yeah.
I think that just died today.
That's actually so funny. I was just thinking about David Nwaba.
It's really interesting, though. And it is something I didn't consider. And I want to actually seg off of that because, you know, Rich, you were mentioning with draft prospects in terms of things you're looking for, both off and on court, you know, off court background check and on court, all the physical stuff. But I want to ask, especially, you know, you came to Charlotte, as you mentioned, 7 years ago, and the league has changed a lot in the last 7 years, in large part thanks to the Warriors. So how have things changed in terms of that pro scouting, you know, over the past half decade or so? Are you putting more value now in sort of like two-way wings who can switch positions between everything? Are you putting less importance on traditional back-to-the-basket centers? Or is there a new wave that we aren't even, you know, the NBA public is so fixated on the Warriors right now. Is there something that you think is like coming down the line as the next kind of counter to them?
Well, I think the game's definitely changed over the last, 7-8 years. And a big part of it is the amount of threes that are taken by teams. And so, like you just said, two-way players are really important. Guys that have some versatility are really important. Bigs that can step out and shoot threes are important. And, teams are also strategizing as well. Like, for example, I just was talking to somebody the other day about bigs that have changed their games. And, Brooke Lopez, during his first 8 years with the during his first 8 years in the league, he took 31 three-pointers his first 8 seasons combined, and he made 3 of them. But in the last 2 seasons combined, he took over 700 three-pointers, and he shot close to 35% in both seasons. The game's definitely changed. And another example, Marc Gasol, he took 66 threes in his first 8 seasons combined and made 12 of them. But over the last 2 years combined, he's taken close to 600 threes and shooting over 35%. You know, so game's definitely changed. And coaches, to their credit, have allowed some of these bigs to to refine their game. And it's also a credit to the player development guys in the league because, you know, Brooke didn't just go out and start shooting 700 threes in games. They worked with him during the off season and got him to a comfort level where he's able to make those threes.
So you're telling me it isn't a fluke that Aaron Baines hit all of those corner threes against the Sixers in the second round. I should feel less bad about that coming out of nowhere because it seems like those guys have been working on it all year would be my guess.
I think as the game's changed, I think player development has also changed. And after practice, before practice, during practice, you're having, a lot of these bigs spend time on things that maybe necessarily they didn't spend time on before. And shooting threes is definitely something that's not just a trend, but I think it's here to stay because you're getting 50% more points versus a two.
That makes total sense.
Can I just ask a follow-up to that? Because it seems in today's NBA, because of these expanded roles, in particular for the bigs, that an NBA prospect, for example, like if he comes in and he's not virtually flawless, like then he's being just hammered by the draft experts. It seems that the demand for having players who are just so multifaceted is incredibly high. Am I wrong in saying that if a guy just has one significant weakness, he's going to, like, for example, drop down significantly on draft boards?
I don't know about that. I think it depends on the weakness and what teams are looking for. I also think a lot of it is dependent on the coaching staff to get the most out of each and every player. So, for example, let's take a player, Clint Capela, okay?
Yeah.
He's a guy that Mike D'Antoni and Houston have done a tremendous job with from a player development standpoint, not only from a player development standpoint, but from the standpoint of utilizing his strengths so he can make a huge impact on that team. And, would he have the same impact on another team? I don't know. But a lot of it is how the coaching staff has used him. Obviously, it helps that he is playing with some great players that can spread the floor and some great guys that can pass him the ball, too, like James Harden and Chris Paul.
Okay, so what you're saying is actually it doesn't really – if a guy has a weakness coming in, that shouldn't necessarily be something you hold against him. You should actually more so look at the coaching staff and the potential of what they can bring out of him. So the coaching staff is simply more important than the supposed weakness of the player entering the draft, maybe.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to figure out is does this player have room for growth from a skill standpoint, and not only that. Does he have the desire to be really good? And is he going to work hard enough so he does improve? So there's tons, and, I've been in the NBA for 23 years, and there's tons of players over the years that have had the talent, but not necessarily the work ethic to get better. And, and those guys aren't in the league anymore, or they're barely surviving in the league.
So the personality aspect comes in a very high regard. Is that this is the kind of the details that I think myself included are missing, because I'm very active on this Twitter talking about draft prospects, but what you really like limited to is the physicality and the stats and whatnot, where you myself included, like, forget to use the human aspect, and as well as looking at, what type of coaching staff is this kid going to get drafted into, because that carries a tremendous importance.
Yeah, it definitely does. You know, at the same time, how competitive the player is and what his makeup is on the inside and how good he wants to become, that's a huge, huge part of the equation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this whole conversation is making me think more. I don't know if this is who you were alluding to, but like a DeAndre Ayton, where, you know, draft experts have started to like really pick apart his defense, even though he's playing out of position, but, you know, at Arizona. And now this is like a free article idea to everyone. Someone should really break down, you know, assuming the Suns do pick Ayton number one, how Igor Kokoschkov is going to work with him to improve that defense. And if he's going to be able to, you know, turn into this type of franchise player next to Devin Booker that the Suns are seemingly hoping he's going to become, based on at least all the speculation heading into the draft.
Well, I was actually thinking just guys in general, because, you know, you look at NBA Twitter and you see, you know, every prospect really being put under the loop. And you just kind of forget about the minutiae of it all. Like Rich is explaining, like the personality and the coaching staff just matters so much, which is very interesting because that's just another factor and another layer that needs to be considered.
Yeah. Rich, going back to free agency now, you know, obviously not every team is in the same starting point on July 1st. Some teams are ready made to compete for a title right away. Some teams are very much in the beginning stages of a rebuild or looking like a couple years down the line in terms of where they're hoping to be competitive again. So how do those situations, those different situations, affect your approach to the offseason?
Well, the teams that are in, you know, rebuilding mode, they're typically not going to go after, say, a big fish, right? So you're not going to give a max contract to a guy if you're in rebuilding mode and you know that, you know, that player might not be there when your team is ready to win. So teams that are ready to win now, they're going to go after the big fish. And the teams that are rebuilding, they're more worried about player development. And player development becomes a big part of the process. And it's all about trying to get better every day and getting the guys in the gym and on the same page. And then also when you're building a team, if you're rebuilding and trying to grow your team, you're going to try to find guys that are built not just from a standpoint of how you want to play and from have the same mindset, basically. And because you don't want to be in a situation where you're bringing in a guy and he's not on the same page as far as rebuilding. So what you don't want to do is bring in a guy and have him upset that, you know, your team's not winning.
I have a question regarding like the rebuilding process really quickly, like, because it seems to me that fans in today's NBA have become considerably more knowledgeable than they were 20 years ago, so they have a higher level of understanding when a team is rebuilding. Have you experienced, you know, you being in the league for 23 years, have you experienced the fans are more at ease now when a team goes into a rebuilding process?
I think they are. I think fans are very sophisticated now and follow teams very closely. And I think there is a little more emphasis on rebuilding and a little more tolerance that way. And sometimes fans want your team to rebuild. They don't want, you know, they don't necessarily want you to be middle of the road team. And so sometimes fans embrace that and want you to rebuild.
Yeah. Some teams even develop a cult around it, as it turns out. that does lead me into another question though. I want to focus on ownership a little bit, because I think in terms of, you know, general managers often get a lot of credit for big moves or get the blame for moves that backfire. But how much does an owner factor in there? Like, is an owner kind of pushing one, you know, are they pushing like we want to speed up our rebuild, so we need to go after a big fish, even though like the general manager is saying, well, we're not ready. We need to, you know, wait one more year before we really get to that point. Just in general, like how much influence does an owner have over a franchise's direction?
Well, I think it's probably different for every team. But, you know, I've been lucky to work for a number of great owners. And like I said, it's different for every team. So I wouldn't want to speak out of turn there. But, you know, owners have final say on everything. So, you know, your job as a general manager is to bring things to your owner and make the case for different things. You know, see how it goes from there. But like I said, I've been lucky, you know, in Charlotte. MJ was a great owner for me, and I have nothing but great things to say about him.
Awesome. Because it's been a big, you know, topic of debate, really. You know, a lot of people are, you know, pointing their fingers at the general manager, as Brian alluded to. But at the end of the day, like you said, I mean, the owner has final say, and I think that has become a forgotten item when discussing NBA teams in depth. So it's the small minutia things that we keep leaving out. That this right. is very important, because now we're going to attack NBA seasons from a different mindset.
Yeah, I think we owe an apology to Rob Hennigan just forever.
Oh yes, yes we do.
Before we go into the big time bite stuff, Rich, one more question, just because we have some listeners out there who are interested in pursuing NBA careers at some point, perhaps going into a front office job. So could you just walk us through like how you got started in the NBA and then like what that process is like going from, you know, an entry level job or whatever to up to general manager?
Yeah, so my undergrad degree was in mechanical engineering, and I was an engineer for 5 years at Boeing. And about the third year at Boeing, I kind of got restless, and I really wanted to do something sports related. I had grown up playing a lot of sports and did some research and found out that a lot of sports agents, people high up at teams and people high up at governing bodies like the NBA and NFL have law degrees. So quit my job at Boeing after 5 years and went to law school at Pepperdine down in California. So my first year in law school, I sent in a cover letter and resume to Wally Walker, who was the GM of the Seattle Supersonics at the time. And I had grown up in Seattle, so that's why I sent a resume there. And, you know, I didn't know anybody in the NBA. I didn't know Wally at all. It was just a blind cover letter and resume. And luckily, Wally called me a couple months after I sent the letter in. And he said, hey, Rich, I like your background. I had worked at IBM also during engineering school. So he said, I like your background, the engineering and legal. And this is in 1995, you know, like January 1995. And he said, I'm going to be down in the L.A. area for a game, and I'd like you to meet me at my hotel, and I want to be the most technologically advanced GM in the league, so I want you to show me how you can make that happen. So I remember it like it was yesterday, you know?
Yeah.
So I go down to the Ritz in Marina Del Rey. And that's where the Sonics team was staying. And they were down there for a game. And I met him in the lobby. And I brought, you know, we had breakfast. And I brought a bunch of charts and ideas with me. And we hit it off. And luckily, after the interview, he offered me the internship. So I interned summer after first year of law school. That was summer 1995. Summer after second year of law school, so that's summer 96. And then when I was studying for the bar exam in summer 97. I did some part-time work. And so that's kind of how it got all got started. And funny story, in summer 95, when I was working for the team, my first summer, one of the things that I had proposed to Wally during the interview was designing a player evaluation system. And I kind of put my my GM hat on a little bit. And I thought, since he wanted to be the most technologically advanced GM in the league, what kind of tools could I give him or propose to him, you know, that would be useful for him? So I proposed a player evaluation system. And so I wound up, summer 95, I wound up partnering up with some guys at Microsoft, which is right outside of Seattle. And we were working on this player evaluation system. And so one day I'm over at Microsoft in the cafeteria for a meeting and with a bunch of the programmers. And one of the guys there says, and this is also something like I remember like it was yesterday. He says, "Hey, Rich, there's something coming out here in a couple months that's going to change the world." And I was a little skeptical, right? That's kind of a big statement. And if you've ever been up in the Pacific Northwest, and especially like at the Microsoft campus, you'll know that a lot of these programmers, they come into work with cutoffs and a ponytail, flip-flop. That's just how the culture is for programming. And the Pacific Northwest. So this guy, he says to me, "Yeah, this is something coming out in a couple months that's going to change the world." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he says, "Well, it's this thing called the World Wide Web." And so, sure enough, the guy was right, and it, you know, obviously changed the world. And I'll never forget that, but it was so funny how that came about. And so that's kind of how I got into the NBA. And after I took the bar exam, still did some part-time work for the Sonics. When something opened up full-time, they offered me a job. And then I was, you know, just kind of worked my way up from there.
Mm-hmm. Very, that's all really valuable information, I think, for everyone out there. So go get your law degrees, start doing some programming, everyone. It seems like that's the way in, if you want.
And work for IBM and Boeing.
Right. Yeah, English majors need not apply, so I've officially disqualified.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm totally disqualified. I don't have a leg to stand on here. Yeah.
Mort, any other NBA questions for Rich, or do you want to go into the foodie
stuff? I think we need to go into the foodie stuff.
All right, let's do it. So, Rich, as you mentioned at the top of the episode, you created a website called Big Time Bites. First, just give our listeners, if they didn't follow my advice at the top and have not checked it out yet, just let them know what it is and how it came about.
Yeah, so I've always, you know, as all my friends know, I've always been a big eater, not just quantity wise, but just kind of, you know, I eat kind of everything. So I've always had an affinity for food, and it really started when I started traveling more with my job. I'd ask friends and coworkers for recommendations in different cities. So, and, you know, I'd write them down in a notebook. And when I go to those cities, I'd try out those recommendations. Some were good, some were bad, but I'd always keep a mental note of it. And sometimes I'd put it in writing, especially if it was good. So, and then, you know, I'd also venture out, not just for those recommendations, but I'd also try places that I'd find either through my own research or speaking to the hotel concierge, or, you know, I like to talk to locals too. So I might talk to a stranger at a restaurant and just strike up a conversation. And so pretty soon I'd have my own list of things I liked and didn't like. And after a while, friends and family and coworkers would ask me for different recommendations. So, you know, my palate's pretty expansive. So I'm able to give recommendations for everything from fine dining to hole in the walls. And you know, I love hole in the walls too. So it's not just fancy stuff. And then, you know, one day a few years ago, I thought about compiling all the information and creating a food blog, and never really got it going until last July, the end of July. Finally started this blog, and it had been kind of in the makings for a little bit, just kind of brainstorming here and there, but never really had time to get it off the ground. And then, you know, finally I got it off the ground and started an Instagram first as a prelude to the blog, and got a lot of positive feedback. So then I thought, you know what, I'm going to go ahead and start this food blog, and got a lot of positive feedback. And some of the things that, you know, distinguish it from other blogs, it's really different than any other site out there. When I decided to do a blog, I wanted it different than other sites, because there's no point doing a site that's the same as every other site. So number one, it's got a sports theme throughout the site. And so like all my reviews are called scouting reports. And any visitor to the site can file their own scouting report. And we have a rating system that has a sports theme to it, too. So there's a rubric for the rating system. And the system is rotation, starter, all-star, franchise, and Hall of Fame. So similar to a like on Instagram, where you click on the heart, you can do the same on a scouting report if you like it, but you click on the fist bump. So if you like, enjoy reading someone's report, you can fist bump them. And a couple other things that distinguish the site are it's dish based instead of restaurant based. Mm-hmm. So like sites like Yelp and TripAdvisor, they're restaurant based. And the reason I made it dish based is when I'm traveling, I'm usually in the mood for a specific type of dish. So maybe I'm in Boston, I want a lobster roll, or I want pizza, or maybe I'm looking for a great burger somewhere. So I'm really looking for different dishes, not in great dishes, not necessarily restaurants. So the dish-based concept is, I think, is different than any other site. And also something that distinguishes it, too, is since it's called Big Time Bites, there's got to be a certain threshold, and rotation is the lowest rating on the site. Got to have a certain threshold to be on the site. So in essence, all the reviews are positive instead of negative. So any user to the site doesn't have to sift through all the negativity that you might find on other sites. Because there's tons of negativity out there. I didn't want that on my site. But like I said, any user to the site can come in and put in their own scouting report. And we've got we just hit 1,000 scouting reports the other day.
Wow.
We've got tons and tons of reviews on there, and a lot of different scouts on there. A lot of different restaurants are represented on there. But like I said, it's dish based instead of restaurant based. And so we've gotten a lot of positive feedback. It's been featured on Sports Illustrated, in the New Yorker magazine, and you know, I'm trying to get more exposure for it. And but so far the feedback's been good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that it's dish-based is, like, really smart, and it makes me wonder why more sites don't do that, because I'm thinking, like, if you go to a restaurant, unless you've been there 5-10 times, like, if you're going there the first time, you're only going to have one dish.
Right.
Or, like, maybe you're with the party, right. So, you know, maybe you're with your wife or whatever, your friends, and you sample some, but, like, you don't have enough information. It'd be like, for the NBA, it'd be like watching a prospect one time and then writing a extensive scouting report, and maybe the guy just had a bad game or a bad matchup or whatever. So, yeah, I think it's really cool. And I mean, honestly, I was browsing through your reviews the other day. I've already pulled one. You know, I'm based out of Nashville these days, so I see you had one recommendation in there for Nashville that, you know, it was an all-star dish that I need to go try with my wife sometime soon.
Oh yeah, Nashville's got a great restaurant there, 404 Kitchen, and I had a great dish there, a pasta bolognese dish that I put in the site, and that's a great dish. You got to try that one. It's good.
I definitely want to.
Yeah, and I'm definitely going to Barcelona to get the sticky rice with smoked duck. That's a Hall of Famer.
Oh yeah, that's a big time dish there. That particular restaurant, Hoffman, has some great dishes. That sticky rice with smoked duck is excellent there. Banoffee dessert is also excellent. I just got back from a trip to Europe and got some amazing food out there.
Are you bringing along lighting for those images?
Yeah, you know what? My wife got me, she special ordered this light at a camera store. Wow. And so I carry it around with me wherever I go, and it's a special, I call it a food light, but I'm sure you can use it for other things, but it's a special light. And, you know, cause a lot of these restaurants are dark and it's hard to get a good picture. So I flash this light and take a picture and hopefully not annoy other patrons in the restaurant. But, I do have a special light that I take with me, and it definitely helps out for the picture quality.
That's awesome. That's dedication. I love that. That's awesome. It really is. That's really, yeah. I'm from Denmark, obviously. I'm, for some reason, we do have like a restaurant mentality, a lot of us, but most of it is really like the home cooked meal over here. Like, we really put a lot of stuff into the home cooked meal. So I'm looking to broaden my horizons a little bit. So I'm definitely going to check out Big Time Bites for when I return to the States and what else. Mm-hmm. Like, definitely. And when I tour Europe again once in a while, like, I'll have that one on my phone. Like, honey, we have to go here and here and here.
Yeah.
Great. And like you said, I've gotten a lot of good feedback on the dish concept versus restaurant, because not every good restaurant has a great, you know, not all the dishes in a good restaurant are great. Mm-hmm. So I only want great dishes. You know, when you go to a restaurant, if you go on a trip and you go to a certain restaurant, you're perception of that restaurant is going to be based on the dish you have. So when I travel, I just want great dishes. I don't care if the rest of the restaurant's not good. I just want great dishes wherever I go.
That makes total sense. You know, we have listeners all across the U.S. and across the world, frankly. So are there any areas of either the U.S. or the world that you would like to see covered more, that you want more reviews for?
Well, I think we could use more reviews everywhere, really. You know, I've got a lot in Charlotte, obviously, because I'm based here. And we've got scouting reports from every part of the country, but could always use more, in every part of the country, really, and overseas. So, I hope people check out the site. It's BigTimeBites.com, and the Instagram and Twitter are at Big Time Bites. You know, you can search on different cities, and we're going to have an app coming out fairly soon.
Oh, nice.
Where you'll be able to pull up the app and do things on the app that you can do on the site as well.
That's very cool.
Before we're to get even fatter. That's not a good idea.
We're married now, Ward. It's okay. Let ourselves go.
I already did several years ago.
Before we let you go, Rich, are there any meals in particular that you want to shout out, like favorite meals you've had either in the States or abroad?
You know, my favorite, I would say my favorite city to eat is Boston.
Ooh.
I mean, it's the great city, first of all, but it's got great food. There's a restaurant there called Neptune Oyster House that's got an amazing, amazing lobster roll. And it's big lump lobster meat in a warm toasted bun. And it's a Hall of Fame dish. I'm really picky on my rating system, and it's one of my Hall of Fame. I think I have 11 Hall of Fame dishes that I've put in, and it's one of my Hall of Fame dishes. It's Neptune Oyster House. The lobster roll is awesome. And then there's another great restaurant there called Ostra, and they've got an amazing sea bass tartare, which is incredible as well. So, and that's a Hall of Fame dish on my site as well. And as far as overseas, I love going to Thailand and getting the local food there. You know, going overseas to places like Thailand, I think there's a kind of peacefulness about going overseas and eating at hole in the walls there, because you go there and people are working there day in and day out, you know, 12, 14 hours a day, and they don't care about the rat race, or they don't care about who's winning the NBA championship or moving up the corporate ladder. And there's just a sanctity about the whole thing, and just going there, having a great meal. And there's a peacefulness there about that. And I just love going overseas, especially over to Southeast Asia not just for the culture and food, but just for the peacefulness.
Mm. My wife has been begging me to go there for a long time. So I'm going to tell her not to listen to those last 5 minutes, or she's going to actually convince me. Rich, thank you again for joining us today. Just one more time, let listeners know where they can find Big Time Bites on Twitter, Instagram, wherever.
Yeah, it's the Twitter and Instagram are at Big Time Bites. And the website is bigtimebites.com.
Very good. Well, everyone, hope you enjoyed this. Give us a follow on the NBA podcast at the NBA Pod on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're now being hosted on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so check them out on Twitter at Almighty Casts. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Rich Cho. Have a good one, guys.
You too, Brian.
Thanks, guys.